Welcome, everyone, to our post-debate analysis and fact-checking special. In the next half hour, we'll provide additional information and insight on the candidates' responses and the topics that were covered tonight. The University of Montana School of Journalism faculty and students have been busy researching the candidates' responses and the topics. We'll hear more about that in just a few minutes. First, let's bring in our analysts this evening, as we have a desk full of analysts joining us tonight, as we've got MSU political science professor David Parker, along with Democrat former legislative candidate Gary Stein and Republican former Secretary of State Bob Brown. All right, gentlemen, let's get just first of all your initial take on tonight's debate in Billings. Bob, let's start with you.
Well, Curtis was clearly the aggressor in the debate. This was her best opportunity to force Deans to make an important mistake that could make a difference in the election campaign. Unfortunately for her, there probably aren't a lot of people in Montana watching the debate, so even if she had scored an important punch against Deans or had forced him to make a mistake, it might not actually have made that much difference. But I thought she did well. She showed that she's quite knowledgeable. She carried the battle to Congressman Deans all the way through the debate. He generally was on the defense. She generally was on the offense. She was pressing him all the time. But I think he showed poise. He showed dignity. He didn't lose his composure. And I think basically that was what was required of him in this debate. And I think he accomplished that.
Gary, did you see and hear the same thing?
Yeah, I would generally agree with Bob. I mean, if we go sort of a round by round, judge it as if it was a boxing match. I think Curtis might win by a slight margin. She didn't hit the grand slam that she needed to win. She also didn't really effusively go out too far to the left. I think she is a candidate who we might see in the future. I don't think either of them misstepped entirely. I thought Deans looked slightly stiff when he wasn't being talked to. He just, not quite the deer in the headlights, but a little stiffer than he might have. But I think Curtis pointed out for herself that she was an independent candidate, that she wasn't cloaked by Barack Obama, and she wasn't running on his coattails in any sort of way. And on Deans' side, I thought he did look rather dignified, somewhat senatorial, seemed to have a good knowledge of most of the issues. He scrambled a little bit on reproductive rights, I thought, and I don't think he got his own message out nearly as many times as he would have liked to. An assertive argument, so to speak.
Yeah. All right, we've heard from the two parties, David. Now it's your turn.
Campaigns hate debates because there's always a possibility that you could mess up and that clip lives forever. So on that grounds, I think neither one had an error that's going to live on forever. So I think in that sense, they both accomplished what they needed to accomplish. The other thing is that one of the things we talk about in terms of campaigns is bridging, going back to your main themes. You heard over and over again from Steve Deans, Barack Obama and jobs and job creation and bureaucracy and large government trying to basically make voters assume that Amanda Curtis is a shill for Barack Obama. On the other side, you heard Amanda Curtis point out to Tea Party, extreme, not one of us, rich, out of touch. So she got to her themes a lot. Now, in terms of the answers, I agree with the panel here so far. Steve Deans looked calm, cool, collected, refused to basically rise to the bait against Amanda Curtis. I agree that I think the Hobby Lobby answer, especially from Amanda Curtis, was really great. I believe overall that Amanda Curtis really was feisty. And imagine this, you drop into a Senate race August 16th. They never anticipated running for the Senate. Who would have thought? I thought she looked really acquitted herself extraordinarily well under these circumstances. She did a good job.
And they are unusual circumstances. We had pointed it out that, of course, this is the only televised debate that they're going to have. They will debate once more, I believe, tomorrow night in Sydney. So limited opportunity there for sure. But let's start to dig into some of the specifics on this. And the first topic that they went after was the federal government shutdown. That has always been a sore point in terms of how that has been handled in Congress. Both candidates got a chance to weigh in on that. Let's take a listen to that.
I'm just asking you, would you vote for a federal shutdown again?
Well, we don't need to have a shutdown. What we need to have is both sides coming to the table and coming to agreement. This was the first president in our history who was not willing to sit down with Congress and negotiate an increase to the debt ceiling.
Amanda, one final
What
final
I
word?
Didn't hear in that answer was no, I would not vote for a government shutdown. No, I would not vote for a government shutdown because it costs our state millions of dollars and hurts Montana businesses, hurts our Native American reservations.
Let's bring in Lee Banville from the University of Montana School of Journalism. All right, Lee, a couple of things that come out from that, of course, is how much did the government shutdown actually hurt Montana? And then, of course, Steve Daines' voting record on it. What did you find there?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, this is one of the situations in which Curtis was trying to sort of portray Daines as a Tea Party candidate. We heard that later on in the debate. And in fact, they cited a statistic there where he votes with the Tea Party 90% of the time. That actually comes from a fairly liberal sort of partisan activist site that's anti-Tea Party. And in fact, Daines does score an 88% according to this liberal activist party. But when we dig into the numbers connected specifically to the government shutdown, Daines did support initially the government shutdown that did shutter the government for more than 2 weeks. And the impact was significant. More than 10,000 employees, federal employees, were furloughed during that period just in Montana. And the impact economically around the national parks in particular was quite pronounced. We saw a report out of the National Park Service later that showed that more than $18 million of revenue that is normally generated in the month of October was lost during that year when we had the shutdown. So, I mean, there does seem to be some points there around the economic impact that we saw around the shutdown. But we can also point out that Daines, as he mentioned, broke with his party, voted with about 84 other Republicans to actually end the shutdown on October 16th. So it may have been a bit of a wash, but we definitely saw both candidates trying to draw that comparison where the other is sort of the extreme non-negotiating hardliner.
Thank you, Lee. All right, gentlemen, let's talk about that since this is such a politicized issue in terms of, I guess, an example of Congress's inability to get things done. Anything strike you about that exchange?
Well, I had Curtis winning that round, so to speak, just by answering the question directly and pointing out that Daines didn't answer the question correctly. I think Lee's right that it's a wash. I think we all agree that most of these things become a wash if they're not a home run or if they're not a major mistake. I think Curtis did a pretty good job of pointing out why you don't want Steve Daines in the office if this is going to happen again. But I think Daines did a good job of pointing out that he voted against his own party with those 84 other Republicans. So it was, if there was any damage control, it was done pretty well by Daines, but I don't think there was that much damage there. I don't even think the feelings of most voters is that strong about, oh boy, I remember that. That was a terrible thing. Let's blame it on Steve Daines.
Well, whether we agree with their priorities or not, I mean, in terms of what was cut as the result of the shutdown, we've got an $18 trillion national debt, and the Republicans, Tea Party Republicans and all Republicans, are concerned about that. And I think the president thought, well, if government gets shut down, so to speak, if he isn't in a position to support government until an ongoing resolution is passed, then the blame for that will fall on the Republicans. And I think he was essentially correct. I think politically it was a good move on his part. But I understand this in the same way that Daines explained it, and that was that he wasn't interested at all in negotiating in good faith with the Republicans to try to bring this thing to any kind of a halt. He wanted the outcome that occurred, and Daines, probably reluctantly, went along with the other Republicans to cause the government to start functioning again rather than have it go on and on when the president wasn't willing to negotiate.
Yeah. David,
the problem with all of this is that the debt ceiling in and of itself as a vote used to be a completely nonpartisan issue. I mean, let's be clear what the debt ceiling is. Congress has already appropriated the money. All they're basically telling the Treasury is, we're giving you permission to raise the borrowing limit to actually to continue the appropriations we already put in place. So much of this is much of a kabuki dance to begin with. And both sides have made the issue incredibly partisan over the last decade with these, and frankly, Congressman Rehberg wasn't one time would vote to raise the debt ceiling when Bush was president, and of course voted against it, for example, when he was not. So again, here I see this issue has become unneedlessly partisan, and just frankly being used to basically play politics. Frankly,
and there's an irony too, I think, in the fact that Obama, when he was a U.S. senator, voted to raise the debt.
That's
ceiling.
Right.
The wedge has been driven by the Tea Party. I mean, the Republicans have their own problems, so Daines has to appeal to voters that may not agree with him, but they're in the same camp. So it is partisan. It's wrong that it's become partisan, but it's become partisan because of this third party, this other column that is presenting a different kind of argument about what's really important. Debts aren't that important. I mean, Laffer and other economists would have told you that years ago. It's what you spend the debt on. And so this politicking over economics is age old, and it doesn't really show a great deal of intelligence by either Republicans or Democrats about what's actually happening in the economy.
All right, well, as long as we're staying on this partisan theme, let's go on to the Affordable Care Act, because that has certainly been a partisan argument that has gone on and on and on, and that came up in the debate once again in terms of the coverage, in terms of the economic impact. There are various issues to go after there. Let's listen in. Congressman Steve Daines answering the question on the Affordable Care Act.
Over 30,000 Montanans lost their health insurance. Remember what President Obama said? If you like your health care insurance, you can keep it. Well, tell that to the tens of thousands of Montanans, the 9,000 Medicare Advantage seniors that are losing their coverage. And they just got the letters here in the last 2 weeks.
All right, we'll bring Lee Banville back in from the University of Montana School of Journalism. Okay, Lee, whether it's the Affordable Care Act or climate change, you're never going to hear more numbers thrown around than those two topics. So what did you decipher there from some of the numbers?
Yeah, there are a lot of numbers and a lot of questions. And that's really what we found in our digging. Congressman Daines has supported, has said that upwards of 30 to 38,000 Montanans had their policy canceled. And we talked to Monica Lindeen and her office that oversees this for the state of Montana, and she will confirm that actually plans have been cut. But what we don't know, and this is where this question becomes very complicated really quickly, is what happened to those people? Did they go on to get coverage in a different way? Did they drop their coverage because it had grown too expensive, that they could find a cheaper alternative? That we actually don't know. And so Lindeen's office even said that if anyone is citing statistics that says, you know, this is how many people have lost coverage in Montana, the people who are running the program actually can't say that yet. So we see a kind of a moving ball around the Affordable Care Act. One of the things we did hear also was the idea that this would also, the cost of it would be about $1.3 trillion, which Congressman Daines cited a recent Congressional Budget Office report that said that. And indeed, that is true. But one of the facts that are also important to highlight here is actually that number represents actually a $100 billion savings from what was initially projected. So what we're seeing is so I'm just adding some more numbers to this incredibly complicated stew. But what we're seeing is actually Obamacare is still kind of, or the Affordable Care Act is still sort of rolling out across the state. We're seeing a new round of people be able to sign up next month. And so this number of how many people actually are without care because of the Affordable Care Act, or who have gained if Amanda Curtis is making claims on the other side, it's still really just too early to tell.
Thank you, Lee. And once again, gentlemen, not a simple subject, not black and white. You're not going to roll out a pair of battling numbers and get this solved. How do you think they handled that in terms of working their way through something so complex?
Well, they confused me. And I think.
All right. I don't think you're alone, Bob. I don't think you're in the minority there.
Well, gosh, the bill was something like 2,000 pages long. And I think, I believe the Representative Pelosi, I can't remember, I think she may have been Speaker of the House at the time, said something to the effect that we're not sure what's in it, and we probably won't know until we have an opportunity to implement it or read it or something like that. So I think we're probably still feeling our way with something as detailed as this piece of legislation is. It obviously doesn't cover everybody. It obviously makes it possible for people to get insurance from private insurers, which is a different approach to comprehensive medical care than most other countries in the world have taken. And I doubt that it's going to be repealed. You know, Daines claims he voted to repeal it once, and Curtis said he voted to repeal it 40 times, and I'm not sure how to understand that, but we know he's against it, and we know she wants to try to fix it and make it work. My guess it'll take probably years of working on it to make it work. I think it won't be repealed outright, certainly as long as Obama's president. But I think we're going to be in store for all kinds of confusion for years to come over the Obamacare Act.
Can you all offer something even more bleak than that?
I was going to talk about my own policy and how I've been sacrificing. I have an excellent health insurance policy as a union-paid educator, and at the same time, there have been cuts to our program to meet some of the requirements of ACA, but also really because it's shifting some of the burden into other places. That's a sacrifice that a lot of people are going to make. There have been haves in the system, and now the have-nots are going to receive some benefits, and some Americans don't like that. Some Americans don't like that they're not going to get their piece of the pie in some way and not get benefits when that's what the government is supposed to be predicated on, the welfare of the people. So I don't know why we keep arguing about this ACA and repealing it, because the Supreme Court, for the most part, has validated it in one way or another, and they may get their crack at it again. But I mean, my notes just start, we get into wonkiness. We get into details, details, right. Details, and you can cut those any way you want. And I think Curtis made a good argument personalizing the story, but I don't think Danes did a terrible job in terms of just attacking Obama and you know, repeating the same thing that's been repeated on the campaign trail.
In fact, Mayor, we can't even agree what to call this thing. Is it the Affordable Care Act? Is it Obamacare? And frankly, what you call it depends on how you think about it, and not only that, how people hear it, and that affects how they think about it. If you call it Obamacare, people hate it. All right, very simple, because it's associated with the president. You call it the Affordable Care Act, people tend to like it more. But here's the thing: people like the pre-existing condition, get rid of pre-existing conditions. People like the transportability. They like the fact they can keep their kids in their plans to the 26. All the popular things that people like, Curtis highlighted. Problem is, they don't like the other pieces of the equation, which is, you know, the costs and the fact that people have to get health care. So, but without those things, these other three things can't happen. So in other words, this is a classic case of a compromise solution that everybody hates. And it's not ideal, it's problematic, but it's loaded. People are using loaded terms, and both sides are basically making arguments that don't tell the whole story.
If politics is the art of the compromise, we should know a good deal when we know that everybody's upset about it. Bob, would you agree with that one?
All right, Bob, you don't get to answer that. We have to move on as we go along. Another topic very important to Montanans certainly are the concept of the fossil fuels jobs and the crude oil exports in terms of how that's going to be handled, the pipeline issue that comes up. That was another topic. Let's listen in to Congressman Steve Daines here.
There's a law that's 39 years old that prohibits the export of crude. All the Keystone oil is going to get refined here in the United States. That law was signed by President Gerry Ford on December 22nd, 1975. And so I'm not sure why she puts a condition on the Keystone pipeline. It will all be refined here. It has to be because of the law. We can't export crude.
Lee Banville joining us once again. And Lee, that has been the pipeline law. I think that's been a source of confusion about how that's handled and what it applies to. Is that what you were finding?
Right, yeah, this is another one of those situations. Now, so let's just start with the XL pipeline itself, which is TransCanada, which is the company that is going to be doing most of the transporting through the proposed pipeline, has said that they plan on processing it in Texas, and the whole point of the pipeline is to get it from Canada and the tar sands area down to Texas to refine it. If they were going to request to actually export that crude, they would have to put in a whole process of requesting it from the Department of Commerce, something that they have not done for anything that has been proposed thus far with the XL pipeline. So it does seem like that pipeline is going to be used. The question about the law that we are still digging on here, and we'll post as soon as we find the answer, is it's not actually American crude, right? It's Canadian crude being shipped through an American pipeline. So does American law somehow trump the actual source?
Thank you, Lee. Again, it's another complicated issue. All right, gentlemen, especially with this topic, we are a natural resource extraction state. So this is one that hits close to home. So thoughts and reactions on what you were hearing there.
Well, one thing that I know David and I responded to is that Dane said that, you know, the increasing cost of energy, when in fact energy costs have been dropping fairly steadily. And some economists point out that if oil stabilizes, if gas prices stabilize, then the economy is in a generally healthy state. So I'm not exactly sure what Daines is talking about in terms of energy independence, because we've been moving down that. And then he refuses to give the president or this administration any credit for that. I mean, that seems, if you want to blame the president for some things, I get it. But then you do have to give him credit for the bright spots. And one of the bright spots seems to be more energy independence for the United States.
Well, I don't think this has really ever been much of a controversy in Montana. Right. You know, because Senator Tester, as I understand it, supports the pipeline, and Dane supports it, and I think Walsh supports it, and I know Baucus supported it, that sort of thing. And when you think about it, the oil is going to be extracted in Canada. It's going to go someplace. It's going to go someplace. So I guess the argument would then be, do we want it to go across the Ogallala aquifer right. and down to Texas? And those who are proponents of it say it'll create a lot of jobs, it'll help us to become more energy independent, we can protect the aquifer, let's go ahead and do it. But it seems to be an environmental consideration more than an economic consideration, and in Montana there seems to be overwhelming economic benefit and very little economic or other environmental downside.
All right, so we're going to push on here to get one more topic in, and that is the idea of the Medicare voucher. That was another health-related issue that we had that came up. Both candidates got a chance to weigh in on this one. Let's take a listen to what they said.
Congressman Daines did vote to turn Medicare into a voucher system. A voucher system that would cost Montana seniors up to 50% more in their premiums.
Congressman Daines.
First of all, it's an inaccurate statement. I've never voted for a voucher system.
Well, Lee, we'll pick it up right there. Did Congressman Daines vote for that, or did he not?
It's all about what you call it, isn't it? So he did vote for the Ryan budget, the budget proposed by former vice presidential candidate Paul Ryan, which does include something in it that allows Medicare patients to receive a sort of payment voucher, whatever you want to call it, and then either purchase private plans or actually purchase your regular Medicare plan. And the part of the savings that they would see over this period would be to sort of slowly bring down the costs that currently are projected to be in Medicare. So when Dane says he didn't vote for a voucher plan, it's true he did not vote to actually implement a plan, but within the Ryan budget, which has a lot of material in it and gets a lot of Republican candidates have been hit by a lot of different things, all contained in this budget framework, that voucher program essentially does exist as a proposal.
Thank you, Lee. All right, gentlemen, thoughts on that?
I can't stand it when the parties talk about Social Security and Medicare, because you know what? All the bipartisan analysis are pretty clear on this. Basically, in order to make these systems to continue the way they're, the changes have to be made. That means raising retirement age for Social Security. That means probably raising taxes. But no one wants to talk about it. Democrats, generally speaking, will say, "We'll just keep it the way it is." Republicans, basically, they talk about things like cutting the cost of Medicare and transferring that over to Obamacare. Well, those costs that were in there, the cut for Medicare, were cuts in the program costs originally in the Ryan plan as well. So there's a lot of, I think, dishonesty, that's a strong word, going on here when talking about Medicare and Social Security by both sides.
And Dave, that kind of shows too, I think, how our system has become more dysfunctional, because back in the 80s, Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill were able to work out some minor fine-tuning to Social Security that perpetuated it more or less as it was, but recognizing that people are living longer, that health problems are different, and that sort of thing. And they were able to do that. And obviously, our politicians today should be able to do that common sense thing too.
But that's where I thought Daines made actually some hay and actually looked senatorial when he cited the Simpson-Bowles Act and the attempt at a compromise and a reasonable solution. That's when I think Democrats or the undecided can look at Steve Daines and say, oh, he's not as extreme to the right as we thought, or he may be on some issues, but this sounded common sense. It looked very senatorial.
And Simpson-Bowles has tax increases.
That's right.
So, yeah, I agree with that.
All right. Well, an agreement. I think we can certainly end on that note. That would be fantastic. I want to thank all these fine gentlemen here, along with Lee Banville and the University of Montana School of Journalism, all of our partners here this evening, for helping bring this to all of our citizens throughout Montana tonight. Now, I want to remind you that we'll, of course, be also providing coverage for you on election night. We want to make sure that you tune in on Montana PBS. We've got election night coverage. We'll have results throughout the evening. We'll have live reports from campaign headquarters. So we want you to stay tuned for that. And then the following night, How Montanans Voted, analyzing the 2014 election. Chance to really dig into the numbers and give you a little more analysis in terms of how we came to these midterm conclusions. Well, again, for all of us, we want to thank you for joining us on Montana PBS. And once again, good night.
MTN, the Montana Television Network, in partnership with Montana PBS. Thanks you for watching Campaign 2014, the Senate debate. Made possible thanks to support from the Greater Montana Foundation. The Greater Montana Foundation, founded by Montana broadcasting pioneer Ed Craney, supports communications on issues, trends, and values of importance to all Montanans.